Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Therese Svoboda. Therese Svoboda has published 9 books of prose and poetry, most recently Tin God. Svoboda's writing has been featured in The New Yorker, The New York Times, The Atlantic, Slate, Bomb, Columbia, Yale Review, and The Paris Review. She lives in New York. She'll be reading tonight from her memoir, Black Glasses Like Clark Kent, A GI Secret from Post-War Japan, published by Grey Wolf Press. Hi, Therese. Welcome to Prosody.
Hi.
Could you start off by reading from Black Glasses Like Clark Kent?
You don't have a request?
Let's see. You know, I think maybe, I mean, some of the questions and some of the things I'm going to ask about kind of have to do with maybe the beginning of the project, so maybe something earlier in the book?
Earlier in the book?
Yeah.
Well, I can read from the very beginning where it explains the title.
That'd be great.
My uncle is Superman. With black Clark Kent glasses, grapefruit-sized biceps, lots of brillantined thick dark hair, and a solid jaw, 6'4", and as handsome as all get out. He's the perfect match for kryptonite. He even keeps a photo of himself as a high school Adonis. Veins bulging. Now, in 2004, after making millions in farming, restaurants, and real estate, instead of swooping down and rescuing people from burning buildings, he volunteers for Meals on Wheels. Just what Superman would take on in his advanced years. I suspect this Superman shtick also has something to do with Nietzsche's will to power. After all, Grandma had more than a whiff of German in her Czech fierceness. Make the best better, read the ornately written note I found in her purse after her funeral. My uncle was her baby. He bore a golden sheen that lit his life, made him special, a man with muscle.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Therese Svoboda, reading from her memoir, Black Glasses Like Clark Kent, published by Grey Wolf Press. Therese, I did want to talk a little bit about the kind of how the project began, just for the fact that I think anybody who identifies as a writer has people in their family that come up to them and say, hey, I've got a great story for you, and you know, just let me tell it to you, and you'll write the book, and there'll be movies, and, you know, there is that happens with this, and there's, you know, in the beginning, you're very honest about a certain, oh, yes, here comes another one of those, but what was it that made you start really pursuing this project that you thought there really is a story there that I want to tell?
Well, my uncle began sending me tapes while he was undergoing shock therapy all summer because he had fallen into such a serious depression around the time of Abu Ghraib. And every time he sent them to me, I listened to them, and they were witty and interesting, but I couldn't see where there was a story about being an MP in post-war Japan. It just seemed like the usual kind of soldier's memoirs. And then in the fall, he sent me one more, and I just didn't get around to listening to it. I got busy, and you know, the kids had started school, and I had a new job. And I didn't call him back that time. And he committed suicide. So then I delayed listening to that last tape for obvious reasons, and finally I did. On one side was just a tiny bit of a recording from a radio discussion about Abu Ghraib, and on the other side was details that he told me that his captain had ordered all the MPs together at one point and told them that the prison he was guarding, which was the largest one in Japan, full of American GIs who had been convicted elsewhere all across the Pacific and gathered there awaiting transport back home, he said it was too crowded and that they were going to have to start executing. And then, according to my uncle, he built a huge gallows and he took care of the problem. So when I heard that, I began to work backwards, thinking that this was the reason why he was so interested in telling me all these seemingly benign stories about his time in the occupation. But I didn't really want to go into another genre. I published in 3 or 4 other genres, and so I began with fiction. And But I continued to research the story because obviously it was rather strange that people should be executed after we had defeated the Japanese. Why were we executing American GIs on Japanese soil? It just didn't make sense. So I made many trips to the National Archives and elsewhere, and the things that I uncovered suggested to me that it was a story that was larger than my uncle's, that I really needed to cast it in a nonfiction mode so that people would be able to see and follow the trail that I did and learn more about what really happened.
Before the news of Abu Ghraib had come out, had your uncle had any inclinations or really wanted to talk about his military service before, or was that kind of really the focal point that brought it out?
Well, it was about 10 years ago at a wedding over, you know, shrimp cocktail when he was trying to seduce me into working on the project to begin with. And so it must have been on his mind for a long time. But when he fell into this depression in 2004, my father said maybe it would cheer him up to resume the project. So that's how it really got going again.
Sure. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Therese Swoboda, reading from her memoir, Black Glasses Like Clark Kent, published by Grey Wolf Press. Therese, could you read a bit more for us from the book?
This is a description that my uncle left on the last tape that he recorded, and gives you an idea of what it was like to be a military guard in this prison. The hallways the prisoners passed through were where the Japanese had torture chambers. They were oak boxes that looked a lot like phone booths, only shorter. You couldn't sit down in these boxes, and you couldn't stand up, and after about 6 hours, you certainly made a point with the prisoners. We marched them past these boxes 3 times a day, where they could hear these guys moaning and yelling and screaming inside. The other weapon we had for discipline was solitary confinement. It was a hole about 20 feet in the ground with a dirt floor and a sewer lid on top. We'd lower bread and water down about 2 or 3 times a day. If you're a guard, getting prisoners quiet is the whole thing. You want the prisoners to stay quiet. Now, of course, the actual rules for the treatment of court-martialed soldiers during World War II were very clear. Any corporal punishment, any imprisonment in quarters without daylight, and in general, any form of cruelty is forbidden. This included solitary confinement, breaking rocks, and sit-down cells, the so-called Japanese boxes. Now, of course, you understand that my uncle's tone in these tapes are not of a guilty person. He understood himself to be carrying out his duty, and so did all the other MPs, ex-MPs that I interviewed later on. They had no idea certain facts that I uncovered were true. For example, that no one in that prison was condemned to death.
Yeah, I think, you know, that's one of the things that people struggle with in terms of their relationship or their opinion about the military, is a lot of times they think of it in terms of civilians and guilt and innocence. But just because I have some military people in my own background, they really are carrying out their job, and in their minds it's all about protecting all of the things that we all hold valuable, and that they have a very key part in that. And that I'm sure it was traumatic for your uncle and other people who found out that perhaps some of the things that they felt were really for a better cause, ultimately some of the information wasn't accurate, and they were doing some things that they would have had a lot of, they would have struggled with.
Well, you might say that post-traumatic stress untreated is the kryptonite for veterans.
Absolutely, mm-hmm. Absolutely. I wanted to talk a little bit about the structure of the book itself. You know, it's the way I would describe it is kind of a mosaic text. There's plenty of things that you have to manage, and here you've got some, you know, there's yourself in there, kind of personal history, what's going on in your life at the time. There's kind of the familial history of what's going on with you and your uncle and this correspondence about the project, but also other things, your dad, his relationship with your uncle. You've got military history in there. You've got U.S. history in there. You've got interviews. You travel to Japan. You're managing a lot of things. And I was just curious about how you put these pieces together. Did you kind of write narratives through and then intersperse them, or did you kind of look at them collectively and put them together like a mosaic? Especially, I'm surprised when you said that this was a, you know, this is yet another genre for you, because it feels like one you really worked with.
Well, my agent said I had to write a book of investigative journalism. I knew I couldn't do that. So I looked at various models for how I could feel comfortable in a memoir. Obviously, it wasn't going to be one of those in which we are saved at the end.
Right.
So I didn't have to read those. But I read a couple that were very important. Carol Shields' prize-winning book, of which the title escapes me at the moment, and a book called Poppy by an Australian woman named Modjeska. Both of them were about rather ordinary people, and they were constructed in an extraordinary way. To me, it felt as if it was constructed like a long lyric poem in which information could be played against drama or an emotional drive that could contradict and resonate as you were reading forward in the narrative. So I proceeded.
And I guess with a lot of it, did it come through kind of in the... I guess I'm thinking in terms of drafting. Like, are you kind of assembling material and then kind of saying, no, this isn't the right order? Or, you know, is it kind of associative, whatever would kind of strike memory? Or I'm just trying to figure out the process.
Well, I do read everything out loud many times, and so maybe that is part of the process.
Well, and in particular, I was thinking kind of particularly because you are, you know, you have written in other genres, how you build that kind of narrative tension and the arc. I mean, I know the story had it innately in a certain way. I mean, were you writing this as you were doing the investigation? Because that's the other thing. I think about this with mystery novels and those kind of things where, you know, you're trying to reveal the information only in bits and pieces. Did you write this after you knew everything, or were you writing it as you went?
Well, I won the Grey Wolf Nonfiction Prize in the beginning of 2007, and I added 80 pages to the manuscript. So, and because, as you may discover in reading it, I don't solve the mystery wholly.
Right.
Rather, I open up the questions. And so I kept pursuing leads until there was really nothing left. There was, it just disappeared into smoke, really, or into the past. And so, I constantly revised the entire manuscript as I was going forward. It was a live thing. It was very exciting to work on, really.
Sure, I'm sure it was.
Mm-hmm.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Therese Swoboda, reading from her memoir, Black Glasses Like Clark Kent. Would you read a little bit more, Therese?
Would you like me to read quotes from him again, or something of my own?
I'm thinking maybe something of your own, maybe a little bit longer piece, just so that we can kind of get into the voice of the narrative.
Well, my father tells me that he has something he wants to show me. Earlier on in the book, he tells me that my uncle has a secret that he can't reveal while my uncle is alive. And at this point, my uncle is still alive and undergoing his shock treatment and so forth under the care of his daughter, who is a psychologist. And Dad and I are driving around in the pickup, as we are wont to do. Dad drives over the feedlot. It's not a big operation. It's just a place where the cattle get fed while they're waiting to get picked up by the commercial feeders. A barn, a lot of fence, troughs, and water pumps. Do you see any sick ones? He asked me. He has to separate out the sick ones. I say, that one's drooling. And he says, that happens. How about the limper? Maybe, I say. And he says, we'll see. And says, he'll drive now. I step out of the high cab into the muddy other world of cattle and dung, walk around the front of the truck through the milling herd that watches me so closely with their big brown eyes. I feel as if they might eat me instead of vice versa. I'm glad to see the inside of the truck again. I'm about to say so and why when he guns the truck straight at the sick cow. It bolts. Chasing it, we bounce hard into and out of the gopher holes and run straight up a big dunghill. I'm terrified that Dad's head will hit the roof of the cab and another clot will start its way to his brain. But he's not afraid. He's in hot pursuit. The cow shoots off into the far corner of the field. Dad does a 180 and drives after her, drives her into a corner and then eases her along the fence. There's not much distance left before we reach the feedlot gate when she bolts again, runs right in front of us, and escapes back into the herd. Just then, two more pickups come riding over the gopher holes, my brother's and his hired hands. Dad must have said something in code to them when he walkie-talkied this afternoon's instructions earlier. Even when I'm driving, he's in control. All three vehicles converge on the sick cow's end of the herd, and then that cow is done for. That cow gets herself backed into the lot. Dad squints at her while she trots to the far fence. "I don't know," he says. "You could be right. We'll give her antibiotics then and see how she does." "I thought it was off to the rendering plant." Dad curbs a sorrowful look. "A nice-sized cow like that? Another 6 months, and it could be worth $1,000. We'll let it hang around and eat corn stalks for a while. But here's one that does have to go. You can see its chest heave." "I gave it shots a couple of weeks ago," Dad says. "I think it had some kind of bad flu." "Mad cow," I say. "Those are Canadian cows," he says, not dropping a beat. "But did you know your aunt died of mad cow, and the woman your mother's brother married after that? It was the meat in Hawaii." He says Hawaii, the way they do. Hawaiian meat, foreign enough. "I don't know," I say to him. "It sounds to me like he really had just a deep freezer." Dad laughs. "Let's go to lunch and eat hamburgers." He waves to my brother and his helper, who stay to nudge the chest heaver into the pen with the other. "But what does chasing sick cows around have to do with your brother?" I ask, after we turn on to the main road. "He ought to be back in the world with the rest of us, depressed or not. I'm going to see if I can't sell him that land he sold to me back to him at a profit. That ought to bring him around." When we get home, I check for messages of my own on his machine. Halfway through a week's worth of hang-ups and ranch talk, I hear his brother's voice, twice, asking him to, "Please pick up. Why don't you pick up? I'm your little brother, and I'm sick." I'm shocked. Is Dad so heartless? "Yeah, I heard that one. I talked to him," says Dad. "It's an old message."
You know what what the narrative really makes me think of, too, the voice is very, you know, it captures a kind of directness in the way that we live our lives, particularly, you didn't mention it in there, but your family's from Nebraska originally, very Midwestern. And, you know, for people who only get their groceries at grocery stores, the idea of how they actually get their probably is something they'd rather not think about. But when you're actually in that business, it's all very much about, you know, it's the day-to-day business of life and death, and that's all part of it. And, you know, I think how that really relates to, in essence, a kind of day-to-day existence you have to have in the military. And then when you try to juxtapose the two things together, that's probably where PTSD comes from, because what you're doing at the moment makes as much sense as the day-to-day stuff you do back home. If you're a rancher, you ranch. If you're an auto mechanic, you fix cars. And when you're in the military, you do things that militaries do. And then you come back home and you're trying to figure out how do these two very practical narratives, in a sense, fit or not fit with each other. When your uncle first started showing signs of PTSD, he did go into care, and I was just wondering if you could talk about that a little bit, like how maybe his writing the narrative or taping it helped him in a way that it seemed like there were some other things that weren't working so well.
Well, he was CAT scanned twice, completely head to toe, and they couldn't find anything wrong with him. And his eyes were burning him at all times. And he had had a detached retina a few years before, but that didn't seem to be related to it. No, I don't you know, I couldn't look at the psychiatrist's record, so I don't know whether they had decided that it was post-traumatic stress because it was never really discussed with me. I was just the recipient of the tapes. So, you know, I was putting these things together that suggested to me, along with studies that show that as veterans get older and they have more time on their hands, my uncle was 78, these memories tend to become more vivid.
Right. You know, secrets is a big part of the book as well. I mean, the secret that your uncle felt he couldn't tell, the secret that you're trying to dig out. I think not just for him, it seemed like it was for him and his memory, but also just for your family and for a larger collective knowledge about what's gone on. And, you know, Abu Ghraib is there in the background. And the images that we had and how that now has, in essence, become kind of part of our collective database. But there are, you know, plenty of other things that are still secret. And I was just wondering if you could maybe talk about what digging after this secret, what was it you were hoping to get at?
Well, The larger issue was the fact that there were no records of anyone being executed at the 8th Army Stockade. However, there were at least five veterans who remember hangings. So I began to look at the statistics that were assembled as documents. According to the National Law Journal in 1999, the United States has executed only 135 American soldiers since 1916. According to the 1946 report, which was the same year my uncle served, from the House Committee on Military Affairs that was investigating an incredible number of court-martials during World War II, the military executed 141 soldiers in World War II alone. And the report mentions that, quote, the full statistics of military justice during the war period have not been compiled, due, it is said, to shortage of personnel. In 2000, the statistical abstract of the U.S. shows 160 men executed between 1942 and 1962. A list of 154 executed men was discovered shoved behind a desk in 2003 during a cleanup at the Pentagon. They were executed between 1942 and 1961, according to Richard Dieter, head of the Death Penalty Information Center. How many of them are on the committee's list of 141 is unknown, because there's no access to that list. So, I suddenly discovered not only was it extremely difficult to find out whether or not there were documented executions there, but that we didn't even know how many men had died during the occupation. The MIT professor, John Dower, who won a Pulitzer Prize for a book called Embracing Defeat, is quoted often stating that there was no incidences of terrorism by the Japanese against American troops during the occupation. And that statement in itself seems hard to believe, an mm-hmm. occupied country and so forth, full of the enemy, that there wasn't any reprisal at all. And in the summer of 2007, I ran across an entry in the internet of a French historiographer who belied that statement and listed all kinds of attacks that the Japanese had assaulted the American servicemen with, and even had a statistic which was quite amazing to me about the British forces. The American documents are not available, so his research was through the British, Indian, and New Zealand records, along with American and Japanese newspapers, and he came up with the statistic that nearly five soldiers were killed every month per 10,000 troops of the British during the occupation. They had 17,000 troops, so I did the math this afternoon thinking it would be less complicated. But that means that approximately 2,500 American soldiers were killed during the occupation, if one could just extrapolate from those numbers, which is not a small number.
No.
And it's not known at all. Those people have no idea whether or not the servicemen were killed in action, which, according to Rohner's review of the documents that were kept by MacArthur, were so often Japanese instigated, or whether they were even executed. You know, those things were not revealed.
Yeah, that was one of the things I kept wondering as I was reading the book is, you know, what were the families told? I mean, the person doesn't come back. Were they generally just told they were killed in action, or were they just never told anything?
Well, two other scholars in this field, Alice Kaplan, who wrote a book called The Interpreter, which compared the military justice for a white person versus a black person with similar crimes in Europe, and Dr. Robert Lilly, who had written a book an important article called Dirty Details Executing U.S. Servicemen in World War II, both of them said that it was very common that you would not know how your son died. They wouldn't. They would just missing in action or something else. So you would never know. So I couldn't, for example, research it backwards, take the prisoners who had the most serious offenses and contact their families and find out what they knew. I did get material from the National Personnel Records Center, which had an enormous fire in 1973, so lots of documents disappeared. But the records that I did have were always contradictory. I had a roster of the prisoners who were in jail versus the official dates of their release from service did not correspond. Some of the soldiers were released in the Philippines or in Japan, and other military people said that would never happen. So it was a very complicated and confusing issue as to where everybody was and where they went to.
Yeah. Could you read one more short section for us?
I read the very end. I know that's bad and something that's constructed like a mystery.
It's very generous of you.
I did a lot of research in killology, which is a new field about how the military figures out to overcome the human resistance to killing people. And I have a broader appreciation for their struggle. But anyway, this is my final word on it. Armies deal in death. They have to threaten other nations, to threaten their own soldiers into compliance. If American GIs were indeed hanged at the stockade, it suggests that every war or occupation creates its monsters, terrible incidents that happen in the ambience of killing, senseless. Military killing, the very senselessness of it, the no-feeling killing. Right or wrong, we need to know about such incidents. We need to wake up and face the nightmare, the dangling body, because we pay for the terror and torture with the minds of our soldiers. It's a symptom of the degeneration of a society when such behavior is hidden. The society begins to stink, no matter what. Or is this just what we think or hope? How many times do the cover-ups work, and no one ever knows? The word mystery means to close the eyes or mouth. My uncle opened his, and then opened it wider for the shotgun. My Superman.
Thanks for coming to Prosody, Therese.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a bi-weekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the arts entertainment news weekly published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Amy Sutton and Ziggy Edwards, with special thanks this week to Jay Vega in Chicago. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody on Independent Public Radio, 91.3 WYEP.